This next panel is on state and regional initiatives, and we looked around to find some experts from across the country to come in and kind of discuss some of their specific work and some of their research as well to kind of show us what works and what doesn't. There are four panelists. We thought we had three, so that means we're going to have to move fairly quickly through this to get all their information. Briefly, my name is Ed Paisley. I'm with the Center for American Progress, and I run a site called Science Progress, which is at the Center for American Progress. And this is a site, this is my only commercial of the day. If you have any ideas on innovation, any policies to promote, anything that you think will help engage that conversation with Congress, that's one of the main things we do at Science Progress. We have a great list. We communicate with the Hill. We communicate with the administration. We communicate with state and local governments to try and get these ideas out. So go to scienceprogress.org. Check it out. There's an innovation cluster sector. We're building it out every day. We welcome your thoughts, your ideas, your columns, your papers, whichever it is. So with that, we have four panelists here today. I'm not going to go through the bios because I know you have them, but I am going to go through the states. We have Rebecca Bagley, and she's representing Pennsylvania. She's worked there mostly in Harrisonburg, I believe. I'm from Virginia. I was thinking Harrisonburg. And then we have Rich Bendis. He's worked in Philadelphia, but also previously in Kansas, so we get another view there. We have Matheson. He's with SRI, and he's done some work in Virginia, my home state. And I was looking it over last night. It looks like some very interesting stuff. And finally, we have a new person joining the panel, and I will find his name. Egils Milbergs, I got it right, from Washington State. He came in from across the country, so we'd have the Pacific side of this as well. So with that, I'll go with Rebecca.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here to talk about what Pennsylvania's done in relation to. We haven't been calling innovation. We've just been using technology-based economic development. Of course, there's a lot of crossover, you know, definitional issues about innovation versus technology development. I'll focus a little bit on some of the clusters that we've done, but I want to talk more about the overarching strategy, because I think the overarching strategy is important, because what we've done over the last 6 years is take disparate programs in other areas and roll them into technology investment, and then on top of that, create collaborations with Department of Environmental Protection, Labor and Industry, and other departments to make sure that we have sort of an aligned technology strategy. The mission of the Technology Investment Office is to serve as a catalyst for growth and competitiveness for Pennsylvania companies and universities. We do that through funding, support services, partnerships. We take an extremely active role. We don't think of ourselves as just grant managers. We look at, I'll talk about how we look at it in a second, but we look at the cluster of technology, and then we also look at different industry clusters and try and bring those perspectives of the regions across the state and make sure that they're sharing best practices and that we're taking proactive roles in convening people. Somebody said, you know, one of the good roles of government is convening people, and we really believe that's one of our roles. So really the goal is collaboration and customers. That's just who we fund. So we fund every stage of companies. It's all done through organizations like many of you know, the Ben Franklin Technology Partners, Life Sciences Greenhouses. We invest in venture capital funds. So our mission is sort of one removed from the work that we do. So it's extremely important to make sure that collaboration happens. We call these the four pillars of technology-based economic development. This doesn't mean that the state government has to do it. It means that it has to be done either from just private sector, federal government, state government, but there has to be innovation. There has to be these ideas. And I know I'm speaking to the choir about sort of how this stuff is laid out, but I just wanted to build into our programmatic responsibilities. So that innovation, you know, comes from industry, comes from entrepreneurs, comes from universities, so it can come from many different places. You need the capital to be able to fund the development of those ideas, but then also fund the ideas as they go into the commercial marketplace. You need the support services, whether it is a professor who wants to commercialize a technology and doesn't know what the IP process, or whether it's an entrepreneur who needs to write a business plan. And then, of course, extremely important also is the workforce at every level of the company, from C-level down to the team itself. Industry clusters. So I sort of joke that this is everything. I mean, we do pretty much, you know, focus our efforts. We do have articulated strategies around these, but it's pretty all-encompassing. I'll spend a few minutes on bioscience in a second, but we have an articulated nanotechnology strategy. Manufacturing is under my office. A lot of the reason for that is we're focused on innovation, new product development, business growth services. We work closely with MEP and have a network of 7 MEP centers. Alternative energy, I just worked on a team that got $650 million in funding for alternative energy. We're starting to spend that money now, which is very great timing. Consider stimulus is just happening, and so we're able to actually have some matching funding where other states are not necessarily in that position. And we have a telecommunications strategy. Bioscience, just for a second, talking about clusters, and it sort of highlights the state's role. Basically, if you look at Pennsylvania, we have large pharmaceutical companies, we have universities, we actually have 2 of the top 10 NIH recipients in Pennsylvania. We have, you know, a workforce based on those things, but we didn't have venture capital and we didn't have seed stage capital in the life sciences industry. And, you know, so basically you become like the flyover state, but you have all of these big pharma. So we created, with tobacco settlement money, the life sciences greenhouses, and there's 3 across the state. We put $100 million in. That's basically to pull technology out of universities. And we started investing in venture capital funds. We have 32 in our portfolio. Now we have 2 large bioscience funds, 1 extremely large in Philadelphia that can sort of anchor and co-invest with some of the VCs around the country. And so that convening role of government got all those people talking. We were able to brand and market, which I think is important, you know, nationally and internationally as a piece of the puzzle. So we were able to brand the region, be able to go to bio as one cohesive voice, things of that nature. So that was sort of how we did it. We assessed what the region has, where are the gaps, and how can we fill them, you know, not only just tangibly through funding, but intangibly through marketing and other things. This is just how we talk about our sort of programs, because there's so many. We talk about having a continuum of capital and services. So this just mirrors a company's life cycle. So there's a concept, it forms, it grows, matures, and reinvents. And then we overlay our programs onto that. This is like my failed PowerPoint 101 slide, because nobody can see it, to go back to university. But basically this just like throws up there. These are all of our programs. So we need to be, you know, articulating in a way that makes sense to people what we do. And that's the continuum. So, you know, you do university research and development and mostly commercializable. You do early stage commercialization initiatives, funding and support for that. And then you make sure that companies on the manufacturing side can reinvent themselves, you know, new product development, innovation. And so all of these things really focus in on most of these things, I should say, focus in on that common goal. And I would say, just backing up to a second to the biosciences, one of the federal roles that I really see as important is Pennsylvania just looks at Philadelphia. I mean, I talk about the fact that we have 6 of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world within 50 miles of Philadelphia, but I don't mention that few of them are in New Jersey and Delaware. So it's that piece that sort of ties on the federal level, that if the states could each fund their areas, and there's lots of people trying to work on this, but if the states could each fund their areas and the Fed could fund the stuff that ties it together, then that becomes a really robust cluster when you have New Jersey, Delaware, and Philadelphia sort of in that cluster. Or if you look at, you know, Pittsburgh to Cleveland, that area, you know, the focus there. So, but it's tough from the state government perspective because it's taxpayer money. We can't go outside of our borders. We can spend time and effort, but not money there. This is just funds under management. So we do have a pretty significant, these are sort of one-time funds, $452 million. Leveraged is basically the forced matches on those, which is $1.1 million. It's going to vary a lot. Somebody emphasized the budget deficits that the states are under. There's been a huge commitment under Governor Rendell to do economic development, but it's going to have to slightly change. I mean, there's going to have to be reductions in funding. There's a Senate budget out that cuts our budget by about 60%. Luckily, we do still have some of these one-time funds that we're managing that come from other sources of capital, so it is a tough time for the states. We have gained a lot of momentum over the last, 8 years, 10 years, but now, as somebody mentioned before, we're in a possibility of losing a lot of that momentum based on just lack of funding. So I just wanted to highlight, too, basically what we're trying to do. One thing I was remiss in the bioscience is right as Governor Rendell then came in with the stimulus packet, he created a stimulus package that did like site preparation, development, building of buildings, infrastructure. So we had the university piece, now we had the funding piece, we had the industry piece, and we needed the infrastructure to support it. So what we tried to do when we looked at alternative energy is tried to sort of mirror that idea, taking the existing industry that we had, taking the existing research that was being done in universities, and sort of tying that together with everything from early stage funding through infrastructure development. So we have invested in alternative energy. We've recruited some large companies like Gamesa and Conergy to open their offices there. But then we also passed the $650 million alternative energy strategy just last July, and we're deploying that money now. The $500 million bond, we expect to still be able to move forward on that. We did one issuance 2 weeks ago, and we'll continue to issue that bond funding. So luckily, we'll have that stream to continue to build that sector. So it'll be interesting in 10 years looking back with that lucky, you know, situation that Pennsylvania's in, where most states aren't going to have money to dedicate to that, whether that is, you know, tracking that impact on that, having that funding available. Infrastructure, economic development projects, alternative energy companies, and early stage activities. One of the things that I'm extremely involved with, like Department of Environmental Protection and just sort of the cross-agency initiative to make sure that we have that cohesive voice when we talk to energy companies and in development. But one of the programs that's near and dear to my heart is the Ben Franklin Technology Partners got $40 million in the alternative energy to do management support, translational research, incubator support services, and company investments. So I think that development is really important to make sure that you're developing those new companies and new technologies. Just one more thing that I promised Chuck I would mention is metrics. So there's been a lot of talk about how do you measure these different things. I think in technology-based economic development, there's a lot of banter about the fact that, well, it's too early stage, we can't measure jobs, you know, all of this stuff. I don't agree with it. I think that we need to have, we implemented in Pennsylvania a methodology in which to survey the companies. Every single one of our funded entities does it. Not everybody likes it, but the survey questions are consistent amongst all the groups. And we collect sort of, well, we collect 10 different metrics really, but some of the highlights are jobs created, jobs retained. And the one that, interestingly enough, we weren't collecting that came out of our sort of year-long process was new company formations. And I think that's something that technology, and, you know, there's problems with data, you know, all over the place that we can, you know, get into a debate about. But the new company formations, I really think, is something that TBED can hang their hat on as something that's unique to us. And so, you know, the jobs come from that, but, you know, if you start comparing jobs in states to recruitment versus development of new companies, you're not going to be able to win that battle. But if you start talking about those jobs in relation to the salaries, in relation to the new company formations, then I think you're able to do that. And just to reemphasize that we went through a year-long process where we brought together 100 people that we funded and hired an economist, broke up into groups, sort of started to move through the process of what do we want to measure, how do we measure it, and then how do you actually collect that data. Penn State Survey Research Center came up with the survey tool on that. So it was a pretty cohesive process, and a lot of it stemmed from just me when I started saying, well, there has to be a way to measure these collaborations and all of these soft things that happen in technology-based economic development. Our answer ended up being there's really not. There's not a way to, you know, accept your sense of what and some anecdotal sort of stories and case studies and those important things. But from a quantitative basis, it's hard to measure those things. So we have a few measures that try to capture that, but it's mostly still reported out to the legislature and the governor, jobs created, jobs retained, business assisted, and the new company formations. And we've seen great success there, and our numbers hold up with other people's numbers, so it's been positive. So I have that data, and we can share it. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time and attention.
Since we have an extra panelist, and I follow the Chuck Westner PowerPoint presentation rule of the more that you can do, the better it is, but you can never get them covered. We're going to basically go through some speed PowerPoint. But when I was asked to speak, it was really talking about cluster experience and actually what kind of cluster strategies have you been involved in actually implementing? What's the process you go through in developing a strategic technology assessment or a cluster plan? And then the beauty of one of the things I'm going to talk about is that it's the first one we did was in Kansas 1999 and 2000 before cluster strategies actually became real vogue. And so we can look 10 years after that to say what's happened with those primary cluster target areas that we identified and what's happened within those clusters, which ones have worked, which ones haven't, and as you go back to redo a plan, how do you look at it differently? So with that, there's been a lot of stuff about government's role and introductory information, which I'm going to go through very quickly because I think that where we are right now, and since we've all been in the technology-based economic development world, I think we've migrating to innovation-based economic development rather than technology-based economic development. So I'm a proponent that we have to look at a different paradigm shift to IBED, which is sort of the next generation TBED. And if you, what are the goals of IBED? I'm not going to, you can read them as fast as I can, but these are what IBED practitioners need to focus on for enhancing their region, states, or the country in the future. Well, they've also been discussion about the role of the public sector. I won't spend much time on that. And the government's role on S&T. And I know that we've had OSTP people, White House people, TIP, and a number of other agency people talking about what they believe the government's role should be. And I think it's still being formulated around innovation, but it's a very critical time. So that these policies can be implemented. Another thing, and we're all talking about enhancing the economy. If you look at traditional economic development, which was really on the left side, the elephant hunting and the bricks and the mortar, the difference today is really in innovation-based economic development, we're going to get back the clusters, specialized talent, knowledge, access to research, workforce competencies, innovation intermediaries who would be there rather than traditional economic development agencies. Who's going to be the intermediary on an innovation-based economic development strategy? Connectivity is great, and that's why we're all here today, and we need to have private-public partnerships to succeed. So let's get into Kansas so that we can talk a little bit about a practical experience. It is a KTEX, a quasi-public entity created in 1986. It's funded through the lottery. It's not funded through the general funds of the state. It's still in existence 23 years from now. It's going through some difficult funding challenges, just like a number of other states are. I think somebody said 47 states out of 50 are having funding challenges. But the organization is surviving, most importantly, but not at the same funding level. So it's having to look at other strategies to fund its programs and its operations. Goals are pretty traditional for what KTEC does, commercialization, enhancing finance, high-skilled jobs, manufacturers, competitiveness, and lifelong learning. And back in 1998, 99, and 2000, we took a snapshot of where Kansas was after 12 years of existence of a technology-based economic development organization, and where was it today, and where did we want to go in the future? So we prepared a Kansas Strategic Technology Cluster Assessment and Plan. And I'll be honest with you, the original title of this was Kansas Strategic Technology Assessment, and then as it was being published, the whole cluster phenomena started to evolve nationally, so we said, we're going to be out of date if we don't use the word cluster, but it's basically the same methodology that you would use for doing a cluster analysis, so we just added the word. So we looked at the four key sets of partners involved in developing a plan, which are obvious, recognizing that Kansas is a flyover state for a lot of things. It doesn't have what you'd classify class one research-based institutions. There's hardly any venture capital in the state. So you have to be more resourceful in those have-not states than you do in those have regions. So you have to basically link your strategic plan to global and national opportunities that match your local capacity that you have within your state or your region. So what we developed was a strategic assessment framework, and what I'm going to do for you, since I'm going through this very quickly, I'll post this on the innovationamerica.us website so that you can get access to the full PowerPoint presentation, so we won't have time to drill down on everything that's on here. But we looked at opportunity indicators and capacity indicators so that we could do an evaluation of how Kansas ranked in being able to match the national and global opportunities based on the capacity that it had at a local level. And of course, you always want to be in the upper right. Opportunities high and capacity high, but guess what? Everything that you do in your state doesn't get into that quadrant. So at the end of our study and our asset assessment, what we found was that we had four primary areas where we had high capacity ratings, and the capacities on the lower axis, and also there were varying degrees of opportunities based on critical technology analysis, the RAND studies, venture capital, SBIR awards, federal research grants, and where they were being made. We made a decision in working with our four academic research-based universities that biotechnology and medical technology was the highest cluster that we had. Information and communications would be second. Agriculture, which is the lifeblood of the state of Kansas, basically is high capacity, but not, as you can see, not a large opportunity. And then the aviation industry, we in Wichita, we have Cessna Beach, Learjet, and Boeing, and it's the small aviation capital of the world. Though it was low growth, but it was a very important cluster to the state of Kansas for its economy. So what we ended up doing, with we looked at the opportunities and capacities, we had four primary clusters, which I just identified, but then there were enabling clusters which could support some of the primary clusters, or all of them. Nanotechnology, manufacturing technology, and polymers. So the next step was to develop policy recommendations and broad guidelines around what our strategy was. And we had, if you look at this, whether you're doing it for a city, state, region, or a country, it's got to be based on the diagnostic study that you do of your capacity to link to local, national, and global opportunities. It's got to support technological innovation, have broad guidelines like we've been talking about all morning. It has to be extremely flexible and broad, and each state, country, or region must adjust and prioritize policies according to the individual context of their own environment. So the key was, on the recommendations, we wanted to improve competitiveness of our key industrial sectors, and we focused on those we had high capacity. We made a decision not to become and compete with emerging, for example, nanotechnology clusters or Semitech that was emerging in the early 90s. We didn't really have the infrastructure to support that, so we didn't go after that on a national competitive basis. We decided to stick with where our roots were on where we had strengths and capacity to build upon. In addition, the Kansas Technology Enterprise Corporation had a whole portfolio of research center programs, centers of excellence, investment programs, which we leveraged heavily with SBIR, the ATP programs. Back in those days, we had Mark Stanley come out and SBIR managers come out in the state and talk to people about the programs, and Mark remembers driving with me on the turnpike very fast to get here because we were late. And then we had business assistance programs. We created innovation and commercialization corporations rather than incubators. We linked ICCs, we called them, that, and we recruited nationally venture capital experienced managers to manage innovation and commercialization centers and provide and created early stage investment funds around the innovation centers rather than just giving physical space, so that you had professionals looking at commercializing and accelerating the rate of commercialization around technologies from the universities or entrepreneurs, but also had significant funding programs within the state to get those jump started. So organizational lessons from Kansas, and I'm only going to spend a few minutes on Philadelphia when we get to it. You have to have a clear articulation of the problem. There has to be a champion. If you don't have a champion to lead a strategic assessment or a cluster study that's respected is patient, persistent, and is willing to go through a lot of pain to get all of these people to cooperate together in developing a strategy, it's not going to work. There has to be private-public partnership focused on managing whatever your strategic technology plan or your cluster strategy is. The other thing is you won't be successful in every targeted industry that you identify. So at the end of the day, don't try to be all things or try to do too many things. Focus on those things where you know you can succeed and make those your primary areas. Don't utilize resources on those areas where you potentially are not going to be successful. As a result, let's look 10 years later in the four cluster areas that were identified as the primary areas. As a result of the life science, human bioscience area, the Kansas Bioscience Authority was created a couple years ago. And it is not recognized that Kansas is a major life science or biotechnology center. So it's been growing in NIH funding, but what was created was a legislative new program, a $581 million fund called the Bioscience Authority to fund innovative biotechnology and life science deals in Kansas. No federal money, didn't affect the general fund, and it was a creative new financing instrument that basically took taxes from firms that were new to the state, creating incremental revenue, and it didn't have any impact on the existing budget of the state of Kansas. So that was created without federal help. But that cluster is going strong. Agriculture, just the Natural Agriculture Biosecurity Center was just awarded to Kansas last year on a national competitive basis. A $500 million research center is being located in Johnson County, Kansas. That is federal money. So there is a role for the federal government to play, and Kansas and Kansas State University in that region had to compete with people around the country to get the center. Aviation has been cyclical over the last 10 years. Went through a very growth spurt when it was vogue to get into private planes again, but then when they flew from Detroit in their private planes down to Washington, D.C., guess what? A lot of corporations decided they didn't need to have them, and the industry is down significantly right now. But the National Institute for Aviation Research is focused on creating a new composites technology center. And I'll tell you a problem in both Philadelphia and in Kansas. The information and telecommunications cluster has been the hardest for us to actually organize. In Kansas, we had Sprint, Nextel, we have Garmin, you have Cerner, major firms located in the region, but they don't have a need that they have to feel that they have to work together. In Philadelphia, you have SAP, Lockheed Martin, you have Comcast, global headquarters. That was the most difficult cluster that we've had to try to work together. So at the end of the day, if you don't have leadership to drive a cluster forward, it's going to grow on its own. So at that particular point, don't try to waste your valuable limited resources on an industry cluster that basically thinks it can support itself. Philadelphia, it's a little different. It's three states, 11 counties. Innovation Philadelphia was created as an innovation intermediary from a blank sheet of paper in 2002. Similar goals. First thing we did was whenever I got to Philadelphia, everybody said, well, we don't have this and we don't have that. So we did a study to evaluate where we were ranked on an innovation and entrepreneurial index and said, is our glass half empty or half full? And the results of this proved that we had more resources than most people realized that we had within that region. And we didn't do a strategic technology assessment. We created what you'd classify a roadmap for regional growth. We did it in partnership with the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce and the City of Philadelphia, but Innovation Philadelphia was the lead on developing the structure for the cluster study. It was a research approach, was both qualitative and quantitative. You can look at over 150 people were involved in interviews. We had over 200 people working on seven hot teams around the seven strategic technology areas to develop a plan within 90 days around their concept. We did both a cluster analysis for the city. This is the city of Philadelphia, and you can see that financial services and education are extremely large in the city. But when you look on the 11-county region, you'll see the chemical industry, pharmaceuticals, education, biotech are generally much more or larger from a location quotient standpoint. So when you're doing your cluster analysis, you need to look at who your partners are to look at both the urban as well as the regional approach to it. We started with 7 prime targets of opportunity, which are identified up there. This is the process we went through with the roadmap implementation. These were the hot teams that we had created. Some of the critical ingredients of success that we had in Philadelphia. Civic, business, and political leaders had to be willing to work on the hot teams. So we had government, industry, academia, venture capitalists, entrepreneurs all working on each of the different teams. We had respected leaders involved in the process, so they knew that this was just not an exercise that wasn't going to be beneficial to the people engaged, and they had to put vital resources, time, reputation, and money into working in this process. So what happened after the 7 primary targets of opportunity? We ended up with 5 that we actually developed plans around, and today there are 3 active clusters. So through a process of self-elimination or elimination by the leaders within that area, there are 3 active clusters. Biomedical research, as Rebecca talked about, is, Pennsylvania's the number 2 manufacturing state in the country in pharmaceuticals, as well as it is one of the leading biotechnology regions. Nanotechnology, the Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeast Pennsylvania, has created a Mid-Atlantic Nanotechnology Alliance, MANA, which involves Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, so it's a regional approach. And then Innovation Philadelphia, which I left about 3 years ago, took on the mantra of managing the creative economy, which was really a new cluster that was being developed and created back in the early 2000s. And they're focusing about 100% of their time on the creative economy right now. So does that mean I have... Oh, I'm getting done. Okay. Same thing. These are the programs that were made available to support the innovation strategy from an investment, commercialization, workforce development, and Chuck wanted to talk about branding and marketing and research. And I think when you're doing this, if you create a strategy and don't tell anybody about it, it's not going to be effective. So at the end of the day, you basically better market what your strengths are so that other people can be aware, other than the people within your own region. These were some of the ways that we branded our initiatives within the region, developed entrepreneurial resource guides, financing resource guides. We created what we classified the world's best technology network, partnering with Ben Franklin, the Life Science Greenhouses, the Science Center, New Jersey Technology Venture Fund, and Delaware Innovation for the amount of money that would be available per deal for early stage companies to access financing within our own region. And this is sort of what worked. And 2 minutes on this?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Mark Stanley mentioned something about a new concept that we're looking at, and one of the there's a discussion about Valley of Death. And right now, we're very concerned, and I'm a member of the National Association of Seed and Venture Funds, who did a study to look at what the state of early-stage funding is in the country. And there is reduced angel activity. Venture capital basically is about $8.3 million a deal. And state-based technology economic development budgets are decreasing. So at this particular point in time, the Valley of Death is wider and deeper than it's been ever since I've been involved in this technology-based economic development world. The gap is really sort of what I'd classify $500,000 to $2 million for companies. And I see John May, who runs the angel group in this area for many years, and shaking his head, yes, that's the problem that they're experiencing right now. And the other thing is, just to have a proof of concept isn't enough these days. I heard somebody speak 30 days ago, and this is one of the things that really sunk into me. The paradigm shift is proof of relevance. You really need to have relevant technology and innovation that's market-ready to get the attention of funders today. It's not that you just have technological feasibility. So we have progressed to a later stage where companies are going to be able to access funding. So this was a study that NASVF that just validated what we just said. So we came up with a concept with a new national innovation framework, which we presented to the transition team in December, in which Karen Mills was present at that team. and seem to embrace the idea of creation in the blue over there of a national innovation jobs seed fund of funds at about a $2 billion level that would invest in early stage experienced fund managers, angel funds, or T-bed programs that know how to do it in the United States. And it would also have a technical assistance grant program. You've had a lot of talk about this red box over here, the Federal Technology Innovation Programs. It's $3 billion of technology investment programs that exist with very little communication amongst the program managers. Our recommendation is the creation of a national innovation advisor or someone to be a funnel to evaluate whether those programs still are effective and germane, where are the gaps that need to be placed, and what new programs does the federal government need to be engaged in. And then potentially a national not-for-profit innovation intermediary that can bridge between the states, regions, and the federal government. And so this is an initiative we just met with a working group for an innovation coalition yesterday. That is one of many initiatives from all of those associations you see represented there that are in support of having innovation become a higher priority for this administration. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll try to go very quickly. I'm going to talk a little bit about Virginia and just introduce it by saying that economic development people and S&T people don't really speak the same language. One group speaks in terms of jobs and investments. That's their metric, and it's a good one. Others speak in terms of, you know, funding for research and articles and citations and maybe patents. From our perspective at SRI, you've got to look at one through the eyes of the other. Back and forth. Very quickly, Virginia does not have an innovation program. For better or worse, Virginia suffers from what they used to call the Dutch disease. The Netherlands had offshore gas, and this sort of impeded the riches from that gas impeded the development of competitiveness in other industries. In the case of Virginia, we suffer from access to Washington, which basically drives the entire economy. So anyway, we were asked to look at what the innovation system was, and so we went through a series of tasks. We first looked at what are the industries that are dominant. We benchmarked economic and innovation foundations. Based on those, we identified some high growth potential technologies that relate to industries. And looking at the gaps in Virginia, we looked at some best practices, and we finally drew some strategic inferences. Like most states, Virginia is dominated by service industries. If you look at any regional economy, roughly two-thirds of the economy, that is the industries that are there only to serve the local population. So you really need to focus on the export type industries. There are several technology and knowledge-based sectors that stand out. In terms of employment, life sciences, medicine, research and engineering, and IT. If you look at employment concentration by cluster, the key ones are IT services, again, research and engineering, aerospace, defense, national security, and telecom. And these are pretty large concentrations, as you can see, and the obvious reason is the connectivity with the federal market. We benchmarked Virginia's innovation foundations, the bottom line being that the Commonwealth has a lot more going for it than it's getting a bang out of. In financial resources, doing quite well in terms of STTDR and SBIR awards, but small business loans and VC investment are relatively weak. And by the way, these are compared to 9 or 10 other benchmark states that we looked at. Human resources is very strong in the state in terms of degrees and the types of programs, but almost all of those people go to work for the federal government or for federal contractors. They don't go out and start their own businesses. Innovation resources, pretty weak, other than federal R&D performance. and innovation economy outcomes, it's kind of a mixed bag. I'll just show a couple of indicators, and these are the benchmark states we compared Virginia to. And you can see we're at the bottom of the list for patents issued per 100,000 population, very close to the bottom in terms of entrepreneurs per 100,000. And total R&D expenditures as a share of GSP, kind of middling. So the Commonwealth really isn't getting much for the incredible assets that it has, and we mapped these out in our study. We then turn to what could the state do in terms of technology focuses. And it's clear that resources for R&D and technology development are limited, and so you really do have to pick winners. As Chuck was saying, there's this ongoing thing about you shouldn't pick winners. That's absolute nonsense. Everybody picks winners. The NSF picks winners. Corporations pick winners. So it's up to communities to do the same thing. So we developed some screening criteria, what's currently here, what are some industry-transforming technologies, what are some unique factors in Virginia, and so on. And we went through a whole winnowing process. We came up with five industry areas, and then we linked them to technologies. It's important to realize the distinction between technology and industry, because there is no such thing as a nano industry or a bio industry. You have to look at what industries it serves. And so we identified a number of these in the biomedical sciences and healthcare, for instance, point of care diagnostics and computational technologies. The state's very strong in IT, so use it in health, use it in cybersecurity, and so on. So these are the kinds of technologies you could invest in to help promote, you know, new ventures and new activities in given industries. Now, this is another one of those challenge slides, but I think it's very interesting, because what we tried to do was map together economic information with innovation information. And don't try to read it, but as you can see, we have publications, we have patents, and we have major research facility by sector, university, private government. And we also mapped by region what are the industry concentrations. And the darker the shade, that means the more concentrated it is. And basically, this is just one map for the biomedical sciences and healthcare. And it shows considerable assets in terms of innovation and considerable assets in terms of research facilities. But as you know, Virginia is not known for its biotech activities. Another one is information technology. And Northern Virginia has a concentration ratio of 6.38. And I would challenge any other region in any industry to get that kind of concentration. It's unbelievable. And why? It's because a combination of the federal market and all of the internet-based things that have grown up in Northern Virginia. But this shows, again, with different regions, and as we've been discussing, clusters are a regional phenomenon. They have different assets to build on. This is one on energy and environment, which looks at both the research centers, the employment concentration, and so on. And so if you go through the different industries, you can identify where the action is in terms of economic activity and innovation activity, and you can build a strategy based on that. So looking at the gaps in Virginia, the major one being the stovepiping, the universities, even individual universities, want to do their own thing. The national labs, they want to do their own thing. The large companies, and so on. So we identified some of these gaps, and then we looked at case studies, and we looked at enhancing research excellence. And again, by that we mean getting a bang for the buck, getting the economic outcomes, not just the research dollars. A second one was establishing and enhancing collaboration among sectors. There's very little public-private collaboration. And finally, enhancing entrepreneurship and access to capital. As I mentioned, the universities in Virginia don't really, they're not hotbeds of entrepreneurialism. It's their feeder systems to the big contractors and to the federal government. And so we looked at these case studies, and we came up with some lessons learned. These can hold for any state, and I won't go through them, but it deals with collaboration. Utilize industry and technology experts as key players. Leverage multiple sources of funding, and so on. This is the kind of things that everyone's been talking about. The summary assessment is the global and national economic realities challenge forward-looking states to expand industries driven by technology and innovation. If you look at the OECD countries, knowledge-based industries are growing by 20% more than overall industries, and they support salaries that are 20% higher. At the same time, on the negative side, you see manufacturing, at least labor-intensive manufacturing, going the same route as agriculture in terms of employment. And you now have some big service sectors, like housing and retail, that are going to go through the same thing. So both the negative and the positive suggest that you really have to look at innovation as your sweet spot. Many of Virginia's high-tech industries serve the federal market. While this is important and it's not going to go away, it is too concentrated, and the state lacks diversity and needs to diversify its activities. As I mentioned, there are enormous assets in the Commonwealth, but the potential hasn't been achieved. And an initiative to stimulate innovation and catalyze collaboration among the different groups can really transform the state. So the focuses that we put forth were to enhance research excellence, engage the private sector, nurture entrepreneurship and access to capital, and make smart technology choices. We proposed an overall strategic goal and an implementation mechanism, Virginia Innovation Alliance. This was endorsed by the governor and the cabinet, but then the economy collapsed, and it's now sort of on hold for the time being. The overall principles and intent are to catalyze technology and innovation activities and outcomes. I mean, people were talking about metrics. You can map out the metrics at the different levels of the value chain, both in terms of innovation and its outcomes, and ultimately the outcomes you want, which are cluster health and growth, jobs, investments, and so on. There's no mystery to it. You want to gain political support that transcends administrations. Too many states, you know, one governor proposes something, the next governor comes along and says, no, I don't like that, let's try something else. So that's why this would be a private sector-led activity. And increase collaboration among the different stakeholders and sustain and strengthen centers of excellence in technology. So that's basically it, and I have 3 minutes to spare. Thank you very much.
So here I am. I'm between you and lunch. Chuck, I want to thank you for having me out here. It's great. I understand that you've prepared some Pacific Northwest salmon, Dungeness crab, Walla Walla wine, some Seattle coffee. All ready for that? That's it. I'm done. All right. Well, this chart right here is the Thelma and Louise moment that we're in right now. And now, how did that come on? That's pretty cool. Is that part of my music?
Yeah.
Well, those are the tulips, if you see in the upper left-hand corner there. Skagit Valley, those of you who have been out there, is a beautiful time for tulips. And the weather is spectacular now out in Washington State, so it's nice to be here, actually, to pursue my lattice-like career here. Anyway, what's the point here? Well, a crisis is a wonderful time to rethink and reinvent. We've kind of all heard that phrase, a terrible thing to waste. But we really believe that out in Washington State. You know, when times are good, it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, there's not a lot of pressure to kind of change the paradigm. We do not like the term economic recovery because it implies going back to this old house, going back to the good old days. we don't particularly get thrilled with shovel ready, you know. That kind of thing is, you know, a lot of projects that have been kind of waiting. We're interested in building the foundations of 21st century growth. We want to look forward, and we think that this time of crisis and uncertainty is a fantastic time to be creative and innovative. We have lots of green shoots going on in Washington State. What's the common theme among those green shoots who are hiring people? We're innovating. We're creating a new product. We're creating a new service, and we need people who have skills and competencies and everything else. So to us, this recession, depression, whatever you want to call it, will be the mother of the innovation economy. Now, three cautions as we move into this. This is the conclusion of my report. So when I get cut off, I'll quit. Caution number one, the federal government can get things wrong. We are very wary of this spending on steroids that's coming out of Washington, D.C., because it has the potential for distorting local economies and regional economies. We want to take advantage of the resources and leverage, but as I said, one's got to be very thoughtful in terms of how to use these resources. The second thing is analysis, cluster analysis can get things wrong. Cluster analysis is a wonderful backward-looking, you know, set of data about where you've been, but it doesn't tell you a lot about where you're going. We see some major changes looking forward, and it's kind of hard to see in cluster analysis what those strategic opportunities. So those are a couple of points that are important. I guess the third thing is the most important thing in building the innovation economy is not about money. It's about relationships. And it's about the ecosystem of how people work together. The most important resource is time, getting the time of people, of leaders in business, government, whatever, to sit around a table and think these things through in the sense of trying to actually implement some of these wonderful strategies that we've heard about. Okay, so I'm going to do the speed PowerPoint stuff. Let me put this down. Get it in the way. It's anyone's guess how long this recession is going to be. The blue line here is the 1990 recession, which took 31 months. 2001, 46 months. LUV is not a text message, but, you know, are we going to hit bottom like Japan and spend 10 years trying to get out of this? Is it a big U? Is it a big V? You know, third quarter, all the spending kicks in. Who knows? What does $1 trillion look like? I just have to share this with you because here's a $100 bill. Here's a stack of $100 bills, $10,000. Here's $1 million. 99% of the American people don't have that to retire on. Here's $100 million. Here's $1 billion. Bill Gates has got a lot of those. What does $1 trillion look like? 1, 12 zeros, million, million. So see that little guy there? That's $1 trillion, all right? So let's think about this. Our state is going to get $7 to $8 billion of that $1 trillion spending program, right? We spend as a state no more than $3 billion a year in economic development, if you count higher ed type stuff and workforce and R&D and all that kind of thing. So we've got to think very, very hard about how to blend, you know, the stimulus. And what worries me a little bit is that we don't want to experience a federal spending bubble. You know, housing bubble, internet bubble, right? When the bond market starts looking a little dicey and the dollar starts looking a little dicey, some of the spending may be cut off pretty abruptly. So how do we move forward? The important thing is to create a private sector climate for creating jobs. It isn't just about government contract jobs. It's about making the private sector competitive and grow in the future. So we're from the other Washington. The reason I went there, as far away from D.C. as possible in order to reboot my brain, you know, to reset my thinking, because I think that's really what it's all about. We cannot come out of this economy through spending and debt and hope the consumer gets the credit balance back. We have to move forward through investment, innovation, productivity, and that's what we're going to try to do out in Washington State. Now, I put this up here not to be a Chamber of Commerce ad, but everybody in this room has experienced a Washington State product.
You may have flown here on a Boeing airplane. You may have had a Starbucks coffee, bought a shoe at Nordstrom's, booted up on a Microsoft system, and we're trying to compete with Google now, so it's Ping, ping.com. So that's what we want to check out. Steve Ballmer just launched that the other day. Or you might have bought a book at Amazon. I think the most important metric for competitiveness innovation is the user experience and customer satisfaction. So if you have a bad experience with a Washington State product or service, please get in touch with us. We want to know so that we can let our companies know what's happening. We think the most important way to create jobs is to have a great customer base on a global basis. That's the important metric for the future for Washington State. Few quick points. You'll notice that of the major companies we're talking about here, such as Costco, Amazon, Nordstrom, Starbucks, Microsoft, not a lot of government involvement. We do have major research centers. UW, University of Washington, does some fantastic work, particularly in life sciences. We have a tremendous connection with the largest gateway into China and Asia. And when you look at the numbers, people who rated us, Rob Atkinson's work on his innovation indicators was the second best state behind Massachusetts. Fast Company just said we're the first state in attracting the creative class, which we're counting on. We have a pretty viable venture capital market. But I might add that California gets 50% of the venture capital deals. We get about 3.5%. So we got a ways to go in terms of increasing the pool of risk capital. We put together a plan, a 10-year plan. Chuck and Mark Stanley and Berglund and Berge here, Bob Berge, all came out, had a Robin Gassner last year as we were putting this plan together. We had a nice session. Our goal over the next 10 years is to make Washington State the most attractive, creative, and fertile investment environment for innovation in the world. We don't think that's a stretch. Our governor has endorsed the idea of innovation. That's part of her meme, part of our political message. The new director of economic development that we've hired is a former Microsoft executive, very talented fellow, Rogers Weed. Gary Locke, first Chinese-American governor in the country, in Washington State, now as Secretary of Commerce. We must rebuild, retool, reinvent our national strategies for sustained economic success. He talks about managing the Department of Commerce and Innovation, which is really wonderful. You can go to our website to download the report. So just a couple of highlights. We finished a strategy, and that's been step one. We're now organizing the strategy, and then we will be operationalizing the strategy. And here are some of the key changes to the economic development model that we've had in Washington State. So everyone in the economic development business, we attract, we retain business, right? Zero-sum game, you know, someone wins, someone loses. We want to grow the economy, and that means we need an investment strategy in talent, ideas, and infrastructure. It's not just about jobs. We're interested in increasing per capita income. And it's a competitive disadvantage we want to keep. What's that? Higher wages. We want to keep that disadvantage. One of the messages I've constantly been saying in Washington State, particularly Eastern Washington, which has lower wage rates, that you don't want to promote cheap wages. Those kinds of folks that go for cheap wages have no loyalty. They'll find a cheaper place to do business. They'll move on. We need to be thinking about productivity of the labor force, the quality of the labor force, the nimbleness of it, the adaptability of it, et cetera. So it's not about cheap inputs. It's about getting more productive outputs. Top down, bottom up. Well, we don't buy the top-down approach at all. We think that innovation is organic. It starts small. One person has an idea, and it builds out from there, and it scales. So we're on a mission here in order to enable organic growth throughout the state. I'll show you a chart in a minute. Competing regions. Well, you know, in Washington, it's Spokane versus Seattle versus Vancouver. You know, that's Yakima, Tri-Cities, Bellingham, so on. These are some cities you may be familiar with. Stop competing. Find ways to collaborate. The entire state is a toolbox for growth. Close linear system open. I think you kind of understand what that story is all about. We think it's about teamwork, multidisciplinary activity. Locally focused versus globally focused. We're here to support global supply chains. Boeing is a global company. Microsoft is a global company. Amazon is a global company. It is our job to create a business environment to support globally competitive companies. Our strategy is built around talent, investment infrastructure, a couple of highlights. In the area of talent, you know, we import people like Jeff Bezos and who come and start a company, and, you know, Bill Gates, he comes back from, you know, Albuquerque and starts the company, et cetera. We need to grow more of our own talent, so we're focused on that. We're very concerned about higher ed funding. The current deficit that we've just gotten through, $9 billion deficit, has a major problem in terms of how we finance higher ed in the future, so we're having a big discussion on that. Yesterday it was a big meeting on that. Investment, we want to diversify our R&D base beyond the life sciences, health sciences. We want to ignite local innovation, entrepreneurship. Our tech transfer model we're experimenting with, there's a lot of talented unemployed CEOs right now. We're sticking them in with UW, University of Washington, giving them office space, and they're going around and forming partnerships with professors and researchers, and their job in 6 months is to launch a business. We'll see how that works out. Infrastructure, we've made a bet on smart, clean, and green infrastructure. The question we've asked is how to operate the economy without oil. We have the cheapest electricity. 70% of our power comes out of hydro. We are the alternative energy Saudi Arabia of the United States. So our clusters, without going into a lot of detail, you know, agriculture, wine industry 20 years ago, 10 wineries, now over 600 wineries out there in eastern Washington. Health services, definitely leaders in health IT. Smart Grid, Pacific Northwest Lab out there in Tri-Cities, Silicon Forest down in Vancouver, life sciences, you know, the Hutch Center, University of Washington, information technology, Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, aerospace, Boeing, obviously, Twilight. Movies, you know, if you have a young teenager, they're all flocking to Forks. And defense, huge military operations. So we're very diverse. One way to look at where we are is the cluster analysis, location quotients. The big ones are software, computer services, aerospace. I'm not going to go through that entire bubble. But this doesn't tell us a lot about the future. Another way to look at it is this is the Puget Sound mapped as far as six exploding universes, Microsoft, University of Washington, Aldus, Boeing, and how over 20 years these little nascent activities around entrepreneurs spawn 719 companies, all right? So this is an interactive map. It keeps expanding. You can go to the website. You can click on it and see what the relationships are. So we have an evolutionary model of how the Puget Sound economy is developing and some work that's been done with Virginia Tech, I might add, out here. Just another point is that we have the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The endowment exceeds the venture capital business of the entire United States by, I think, twice. Okay. So they are, interestingly enough, driving a whole new wealth-creating sector in Washington State called Global Health Ecosystem. This kind of illustrates the partners, but we've got 160 organizations, mostly nonprofits, involved with this. We're operating, you know, in literally 100 countries across the planet, trying to solve 20 major disease problems. But what it's doing is creating an ecosystem that's going to be sustainable. So we have an example here of philanthropy being a wealth creator. Okay, two more charts. Got the red light. We're on a tour now called the Glimmers of Hope Tour. And we've hit these particular communities. We were just this week in OMAC, which is up there, the middle part of the state, upper part of it up there, and also in Seattle. And we are talking to the local civic and business leadership about where they see their strategic opportunities, what their vision is, what their projects are, et cetera, their financial plan. We plan to take those projects, put them onto a virtual Google map, virtual Earth, that will give you an opportunity and anyone in the world an opportunity to fly around in this virtual environment, identify the project, and establish a relationship with that project. Follow it like Twitter, invest in it, collaborate with it and contribute to it. We'd be happy to help out anybody on marine and boat building. Lee Cheatham pointed out to me that we have a great capability there, and so forth, or just simply use the output of it. So this is very exciting in terms of where, how we're building this thing from the bottom up. Eventually, we will be connecting the regions together and, as I say, using the entire state as a toolbox. So we are the social and economic laboratory of democracy that Mark Stanley kind of pointed out. On metrics, we're building a metric system, but what it does is represent an economic model of how inputs drive the business environment and how the business environment in turn creates wealth and jobs and ultimately state revenues that feed back. So it's not a list of 29 indicators, kind of static. It's a dynamic model. Washington Technology Center and our commission are cooperating on putting that together. So these are sort of some issues which I don't have time to go through. These are things that we're addressing. And let me conclude by saying the best way to predict the future is to invent it. Not my statement, Alan Case. But thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. I think we had a very stimulating panel there, and I are in our debt to each of the speakers.